Our West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Armed Libyan militia attack parliament, seeking Islamist lawmakers. Suicide bomber kills four in northern Nigerian city of Kano. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Militia loyal to a retired Libyan general say they've suspended parliament after launching an attack against the legislative body. Gunmen commanded by General Khalifa Haftar Sunday stormed the parliament building in Tripoli, firing weapons, ransacking offices. Officials say the militia attacked the building in an attempt to arrest Islamist lawmakers. A security official said they also shelled nearby military base and controlled several zones in southern Tripoli around the capital's airport. The violence came after deadly fighting in the eastern city Benghazi Friday between the general's so-called National Army and Islamist militia. A suicide car bomber killed at least four people Sunday in a Christian neighborhood of the northern Nigerian city of Kano. Police say the blast occurred on a street with a number of bars and restaurants. There's been no claim of responsibility, but suspicion is likely to fall on Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group using terrorism to set up a conservative Islamic state in northern Nigeria. Boko Haram holding more than 270 schoolgirls hostage, having kidnapped them from their village last month. One prominent Nigerian Muslim leader suggests dialogue with militants may be one way to resolve the matter, as Heather Murdoch reports.
Abdullahi Bayero is the spokesperson for the Supreme Council of Sharia in Nigeria. He says the military has failed to rescue the girls, but dialogue might save them.
Formally, the government are saying you cannot deal with a ghost. You don't know whom you are dealing with. They are doing guerrilla wars. They are doing this, they are doing that. Now, in the infinite mercy of God, these people, these insurgents, we know where they are.
Even if the girls are rescued, he says, without negotiations, the circumstances in which Boko Haram emerged will remain and the group will continue to thrive. Boko Haram began as a fundamentalist sect in the early 2000s, becoming violent in 2009. Bayero says its anti-government and anti-Western ideology took root in part because most people in northeastern Nigeria live in abject poverty. Boko Haram has now grown into an extremist insurgency, killing thousands of people, including hundreds of schoolchildren. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Roman Catholic worshippers Sunday prayed for the safe return of the abducted girls. The Reverend Victor Avachia is associate priest of the 12 Apostles Catholic Church.
Christians and Muslims alike are not being spared. And so I see it more from the perspective of terrorism. We're living in a culture of death. It's not only Boko Haram. Kidnappers are everywhere. Armed robbers are everywhere. And I see this as a menace that really needs to be handled from a spiritual and a physical angle.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan and other African leaders attended a French-organized meeting in Paris Saturday on ways to deal with terrorists. The International Child Welfare Agency, UNICEF, has warned hundreds of thousands of children in South Sudan are in imminent risk of death and disease. UNICEF said Sunday 80% of the children under the age 5 in South Sudan's three worst conflicted areas, Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity, are in grave danger. It said nearly 500,000 across the country could die of malnutrition. Nearly 740,000 are at risk of food insecurity. Rwandan police dismissed allegations by Human Rights Watch accusing the government of engaging in forced disappearances, pointing rather to the arrest of more than 30 people suspected of terrorist activity. Meanwhile, a Rwandan military court has ruled it is competent to try 14 civilians accused of terrorism. Nick Long reports from Kigali.
The defendants are charged with belonging to terrorist movements and with involvement in an alleged terrorist campaign last September when grenades exploded in a marketplace and on a street in Kigali a few days before parliamentary elections. The alleged ringleaders of the group were arrested in Uganda last year and extradited to Rwanda. The court has seen video testimony from two of the accused, Joseph Nshimiyimana and Innocent Kalisa. Nshimiyimana is accused of bringing the grenades to Kigali from the Democratic Republic of Congo, although prosecutors say the people who actually threw the grenades are still on the run. Kalisa is accused with a co-defendant, Lieutenant Mutabazi, of plotting to assassinate President Paul Kagame aboard a boat on Lake Mahazi in the east of the country. Tribunal President Major Bernard Hategekimana announced that the trial will continue on June the 17th. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More on the internet at voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawians go to the polls tomorrow, Tuesday, where President Joyce Banda is seeking re-election.
I've been to many places here in Malawi. The first thing is it's very peaceful. I've not even seen anyone pointing finger at another candidate or wagging a finger or taunting them, nothing.
Setumbiko Musokutwani is a member of the SADC Election Observer Mission. Rwanda police deny missing persons report. A Kenya-born American professor responds to allegations he's seeking regime change in Kenya. And UNICEF says South Sudan children are in dire need as a high-level pledging conference opens tomorrow Tuesday in Oslo, Norway.
We are hopeful that this high-level conference will really bring together some of the greatest minds in the humanitarian world to try and ease humanitarian access.
Sarah Crowe is chief of crisis communications for UNICEF. A renegade Libyan general suspends parliament after attacking it. And Hong Kong destroys nearly 30 tons of ivory. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The deputy leader of the Southern African Development Community's SADC Parliamentary Forum Poll Observer Mission says Malawi's Electoral Commission has assured the group it has made adequate preparations to administer the country's first tripartite elections on tomorrow, Tuesday. Setumbiko Musokutwani tells reporter Peter Clotty that he's hopeful there would be no violence during Tuesday's election because Malawians have conducted themselves well during the campaigning period ahead of the election.
Since we came, it has been very peaceful. And the Malawi Electoral Commission, they've told us in a briefing last week that they have everything in place. That will have to be tested today and tomorrow because that's when we expect the voting materials to be arriving at the voting stations. But so far, they indicated to us that everything is under control.
You witnessed some of the campaigning activities in the run-up to the election. How was the campaigning and how are prospective Malawians behaving ahead of the election?
Yeah, well, I've been to many places here in Malawi. I've been to rural parts of Malawi, such as Chinji near the Zambian border. And, of course, I'm a resident in Lilongwe, so I have a picture of both the rural and the outlying parts. The first thing is it's very peaceful. I've not even seen anyone pointing finger at another candidate or wagging a finger or taunting them, nothing. The campaigning themselves, from what we've been seeing, are extremely quiet. It's all very quiet. Of course, a rally is a very jubilant place. There's lots of music, lots of dancing, and lots of performances, but it has been extremely peaceful.
From the meetings you've had with other stakeholders, civil society groups, the Electoral Commission, as well as the political parties, what is the coordination to ensure transparency of the elections?
We had briefings from a civil society umbrella organization. They also gave us their perspective. We had meetings with academics. Of course, like everywhere else, now and then there were accusations of wrongdoing, which, of course, were not verified. We encourage people, when they see wrongdoing, first of all, to report to the Malawi Electoral Commission because they and they alone have the authority to intervene in cases where anything is going wrong. The civil society people also, I think, when they talk to us, they said they are reasonably comfortable that everything is running well. Again, of course, they do express concerns here and there. And once again, we encourage them to go and speak to the Malawi Electoral Commission, or if they have direct evidence of what they are fearing, to share that with us, which we shall be very happy to pass on to the Malawi Electoral Commission. We also had a meeting with one member of the diplomatic missions stationed here in Malawi, who gave us their perspective. And from what they said, they seem to be satisfied that things were going to order. They also indicated they did receive complaints in here and there, which they said were unverified.
Setumbiko Musokutwani is the deputy leader of the Southern African Development Community's Parliamentary Forum Election Observer Mission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is calling on all parties in the South Sudan conflict to provide unhindered access for humanitarian assistance and to stop violence against children. The agency says hundreds of thousands of South Sudan children are at risk of death and disease. The appeal comes on the eve of tomorrow Tuesday's high-level humanitarian pledging conference for South Sudan in Oslo, Norway. Sarah Crowe is chief of crisis communications for UNICEF. She tells me the situation is especially dire in South Sudan's three most conflict-affected states of Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity.
We had warned for many months now that children would face greater risk of disease and indeed malnutrition. So right now we have 50,000 children who could indeed die of malnutrition. We have cholera outbreak that has just been confirmed in the past couple of days by the Ministry of Health in South Sudan. Some 78 people have been affected by that and three deaths. So we are seeing a situation where the country is unraveling and this is affecting children's every day. Right now, what they need is humanitarian assistance. They need their leaders to protect their lives, their rights, and indeed their futures. And the world needs to listen. It feels right now as if the world is not listening, that the world has turned its back on South Sudan.
So what are your expectations for the Oslo conference?
Well, we are hopeful that this high-level conference will really bring together some of the greatest minds in the humanitarian world to try and ease humanitarian access.
You said it seems as though that the world has forgotten the people of South Sudan, but you know that both parties in the conflict in South Sudan recently signed a cessation of hostilities agreement and they broke it. Is there a particular message from UNICEF for them?
Well, children need peace. Children need to know from their leaders, and that means all parties to the conflict in South Sudan, children need to know from their leaders that their lives will be protected. And the longer this goes on, the less chance they have of their lives being protected. So it's not just about the actual fighting itself, but because of this situation, because children have been forced into overcrowded and unsanitary conditions, and their schools and hospitals have been attacked and used by parties to the conflict, because 9,000 children have been recruited into armed forces by both sides, and because thousands of children have been separated from their families within South Sudan, they need to know that this will end soon. Otherwise, their lives are at risk.
So you have called for an unhindered and safe access to humanitarian assistance.
That's right. So we're finding that due to the intense fighting, which has gone up and down since December 15th, 2013, and the result of this is that people cannot get on with their lives. So this has put so much burden on families within South Sudan. And it is not just South Sudan at the moment. It is all the neighboring countries that have had to take in refugees from South Sudan. And they themselves are in a vulnerable position.
Sarah Crowe is Chief of Crisis Communications for UNICEF. She was speaking with me from New York City. Armed men attacked the building where Libya's parliament was meeting on Sunday and ransacked lawmakers' offices. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
Two militia units loyal to a retired general stormed Libya's parliament building, ransacking lawmakers' offices and firing automatic weapons into the air. Shelling could also be heard in the vicinity of the building as clouds of black smoke poured into the air. Libyan state TV reported the armed units kidnapped Speaker Nouri Boussakhmeyn and seven other lawmakers. Al Jazeera TV and the local Libyan Al-Mada network reported that Boussakhmeyn denied he had been kidnapped. Earlier, at a news conference, Boussakhmeyn had called the attack by men loyal to former Army Chief of Staff Khalifa Haftar a coup against Libya's legitimate government and called on opposing militias belonging to mostly Islamist groups to counter the attacks. He said General Haftar and his supporters should be arrested. General Haftar's supporters told Al Arabiya TV the attack on the parliament building was intended to block the appointment of a new government under businessman Ahmed Maitik. Maitik's appointment as prime minister 2 weeks ago was disputed by top lawmakers who claimed his confirmation vote took place without a quorum. Maitik is supported by Islamist lawmakers and militias. A pro-Western prime minister, Ali Zaidan, was removed from office in a disputed vote of no confidence early last month. General Haftar insisted in a video message broadcast on Arab TV networks that military operations he was conducting were in response to a demand by the Libyan people to restore order and rid the country of terrorism. Libya's outgoing caretaker prime minister, Abdullah Thani, issued a statement read on Libyan TV accusing General Haftar's forces of trying to topple Libya's legitimate government. Forces loyal to General Haftar blocked roads around the parliament building as well as a road leading to the capital's main airport. Arab satellite channels also reported warplanes loyal to the general overflew the capital. His forces fought against Islamist militias in the eastern city of Benghazi on Friday. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's Monday morning, May 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Rwanda's national police have dismissed allegations by Human Rights Watch that a number of people have gone missing or are victims of forcible disappearance in the north and west of the country. Nick Long has more for VOA from Kigali.
The police were reacting to a report that Human Rights Watch published on Friday. The group said an increasing number of people have been forcibly disappeared or have been reported missing in Rwanda since March. The report cited 14 cases. In response, the police spokesman, Assistant Commissioner of Police Damas Gatare, said there are no missing persons and the accusations are false, baseless and have no evidence. Gatari's statement explained that during recent operations to arrest suspects alleged of conspiracy against established government and terror activities, some people were apprehended. He said it took time to crack down this network, but added, "We have over 35 suspects who will be handed over to prosecution." The police spokesman said the operation was conducted in partnership with the general population, local leaders and other security organs, and followed credible information provided by members of the public. He added that the security organs enforce laws in a professional manner and there was therefore no cause for alarm. Reacting to the police statement, Human Rights Watch researcher Karina Tetsakian said she hopes the authorities will physically produce the people being held. The Assistant Commissioner of Police also gave details of the death of a suspect who was shot and killed on Friday. Gatare said Alfred Nsengimana tried to escape while taking investigators to a place where he said guns were hidden and was shot and killed by a Rwanda Correctional Services guard. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
A Kenyan-born American professor says he's not calling for regime change in Kenya through his writings, but Professor Makau Mutua, dean of the University of Buffalo Law School, says having a leader of a country who is under indictment is not a good thing. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Deputy President William Ruto are facing charges at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, for allegedly coordinating the 2007 post-election violence during which more than 1,000 people were killed. Professor Makau tells me he has serious doubts about the legitimacy of both Kenyatta and Ruto as leaders of Kenya.
Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta and Mr. William Ruto, the two individuals who are indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity because of the violence in Kenya in 2008. These two individuals, as you know, were elected in 2013, last year in March, while they were under indictment. It is no secret, and I have not made a secret of it, that I thought the election was highly compromised, most probably stolen. In any case, I think it was wrong for Kenyans to elect individuals who are indicted for crimes against humanity. And so I have serious questions about the legitimacy of the regime under Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto.
But you're not calling for a change in regime?
What I've said is that the International Criminal Court should pursue these individuals, pursue the charges, levy it against them. My understanding is that the witnesses for Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto have either disappeared, have been killed, been intimidated. Some of them have been bribed, and so the cases have become quite difficult. The Kenyan government has refused to cooperate with the International Criminal Court to pursue these individuals. But I think that you'll agree with me that having a leader of a country who is under indictment by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity is not a good thing.
I'm sure you are aware of the African Union position on this matter.
The African Union position is not only hypocritical, it is very, very sad, and it's really a position that supports impunity. At the same time, the AU is speaking out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it supports the ICC process against former President Gbagbo of the Ivory Coast, while opposing the trial of, you know, of Mr. Kenyatta.
Professor Makau Mutua, Dean of the University of Buffalo Law School, was speaking with me from Buffalo, New York. David Nyakurash Masanga, CEO of the Pan-African Forum, says Mutua is a paper mercenary who, through his weekly columns in the Sunday Nation newspaper and most recently in the Sunday Standard, has been spreading ethnic hatred and calling for a regime change in Kenya similar to Egypt and Tunisia. Masanga says he and others have decided to defend Africa and Kenya against what he calls Professor Mutua's malaise.
Everybody in Africa, Kenya in particular, has been reading Professor Makau Mutua's articles in the East African Standard, or the Standard newspaper of Kenya. On several occasions, Professor Makau Mutua has been at the forefront on the ICC cases against Uhuru Kenyatta and Ruto and the other Okapo Six. Professor Makau Mutua is a Kenyan. Now, the last 3 weeks, I've seen Professor Makau Mutua pen several dangerous articles, articles that can bring this nation, calling Kenya, to a regime change, articles that actually divide the people of Kenya. And therefore, I have decided with very many other people that on a weekly basis, we shall be sending a reply to Professor Makau Mutua and put it on an international page, so that every day we shall actually bring out facts according to what he has written in his weekly Sunday outburst against the government of Uhuru Kenyatta and Ruto and others, so that the people of Kenya can understand who Professor Mutua is.
David Nyakurach Masanga is the CEO of the Pan-African Forum. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. Authorities in Hong Kong last Thursday began the process of destroying nearly 30 tons of ivory, arguing that it was too expensive to safeguard one of the world's largest accumulations of elephant tusks. While conservationists praise the gesture, many insist that more needs to be done in Asia to help tackle the poaching of critically endangered elephant and rhino species. Ivan Broadhead reports.
After years of indecision, the Hong Kong government has incinerated the first ton of ivory from its vast stockpile of elephant tusk, confiscated from wildlife crime syndicates since 2004. Speaking at the facility where the 35 barrels of chopped ivory were destroyed, the head of the Endangered Species Advisory Committee, Paul Shin, told reporters that Hong Kong was intent on helping end elephant poaching.
Today is not a celebration, but a solemn reminder of the tragedy that so many elephants have been illegally killed solely for the market value of their tusks.
The semi-autonomous Chinese city is a major transshipment hub for the illegal trade in elephant tusk and rhino horn. Last year, local officials seized 8 tons of ivory from countries as far away as Nigeria and South Africa that were en route to increasingly affluent consumers across Asia. Members of the Government Advisory Committee had faced criticism for their previous reluctance to destroy the stockpile. They cited its potential resale value on the legal market as prices soared. With China and the United States beginning to incinerate their own stockpiles earlier this year, officials announced in January that Hong Kong would incinerate 28 tons of tusk by mid-2015. That process could help educate Asian consumers, not just about animal conservation, but about wider issues linked to elephant and rhino poaching, including armed conflict, says Julie Ayling of the Transnational Environmental Crime Project at Australian National University.
for example. The evidence indicates that some militias, insurgent groups in Africa have become involved in the illegal wildlife trade. There's a suggestion that the Janjaweed from the Sudan have been involved in ivory smuggling to make money.
A decade ago, Japan was a major ivory consumer. Today, that market has diminished considerably as younger generations turn their back on the commodity, with several Hong Kong retailers this week announcing they will no longer sell ivory products. The hope is that the incineration of the Hong Kong stockpile might spark a similar success. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Egypt's Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed stole the limelight at the IWF Diamond League in Shanghai, China, when he triumphed with a new Africa javelin record of 89.21 meters on Sunday. The old mark of 88.75 meters by South African Marius Corbett stood since 1998. Nigerian Blessing Okagbare sparkled when she prevailed in the women's long jump with a leap of 6.86 meters before she won the 200 meters in 22.36 seconds. Kenyan Robert Kiptobi Watt pipped Algerian Olympic champion Taufik Makloufi to win the men's 800 meters in 1 minute and 44.69 seconds, while Ethiopian Yeneu Alimereo triumphed in the 5,000 meters in 13 minutes and 4.83 seconds. Senegal's Mamadou Kasse Hanna, Botswana's Amantle Moncho, and Ethiopian Sofia Sefa were runners-up in the men's 400-meter hurdles, women's 400 meters, and women's 3,000 meters steeplechase, respectively. In football, Madagascar edged Uganda 2-1, Central African Republic and Guinea-Bissau drew 0-0 as Liberia pipped Lesotho 1-0 in preliminaries for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers played on Sunday. Mauritania pipped Equatorial Guinea 1-0, Malawi beat Chad 2-0, Tanzania edged Zimbabwe 1-0, Libya and Rwanda drew 0-0 as did Burundi and Botswana. In other matches, Benin dismissed Sao Tome and Principe 2-0, Namibia edged Congo-Brazzaville 1-0, Swaziland and Sierra Leone drew 1-1, Kenya pipped Comoro Islands 1-0, and Mozambique ran over South Sudan 5-0. Elsewhere, Tunisia's CS Sfaxien beat Libya's El Ahli Benghazi 3-1 as the Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita edged Egypt's Zamalek 2-1 in mini-league Orange Africa Champions League action on Sunday. Algeria's Entente Setif pipped Tunisia's Esperance 2-1, and Sudan's El Hilal edged the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe 1-0. Meanwhile, Egypt's El Ahli beat Zambia's Nkana 2-0 in Orange Africa Confederations Cup mini-league action on Sunday. Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa and Sewe Sports drew 1-1 with Mali's AS Real de Bamako and Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel, respectively. Finally, the week-long Africa Junior and Youth Wrestling Championship starts in Alexandria, Egypt today, Monday. The contest is also Africa's qualifier for the World Youth Olympic Games in Nanjing, China in August. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, May 19th.
Dear Daybreak Africa and listeners across the world, permit me use your medium to call on Islamic extremists Boko Haram and their sponsors in Nigeria to please remember that with all they have done, it is impossible for them to turn this country, Nigeria, to an Islamic state and send Western education packing, as their name implies. This call became very necessary because Nigeria is made up of over 250 ethnic groups and several religions. And so how possible can that be? Albert Alago, Tom Obudu Cattle Ranch Base of Award in Obaniku Local Government Area of Kwasura State, Nigeria. Thank you.
And we thank you, listener, for your comment. And that's it for this Monday morning, May 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butterson. Have a lovely week, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.